EPC or epilepsy partiale continuous. They might just have a thumb that twitches. Would you put somebody under general anesthesia for that? I don't think we know the answer for that. There isn't any long-term outcome studies on that. We mentioned before all the complications that come with iatrogenic coma and putting people under general anesthesia for days or weeks. What I've found in my practice over 20 plus years is that those seizures come right back.
What are the most common types of seizures that one could anticipate to see in the ICU?
Yeah, so this has been looked at, you know, pretty extensively, and non-convulsive seizures by far and away, over 80% of what we see when we do find seizures are clinically silent or clinically unapparent, or maybe you have a little face twitching, something like that, maybe transient eye deviation. So very subtle clinical signs, but not overt generalized tonic-clonic type shaking that you might expect with even generalized seizures. So you might see a focal seizure. A lot of patients will have one area of their brain that's irritable. And so you get a primary focal seizure that then secondarily generalizes, but that doesn't generate a full body shaking. So there's this sort of electromechanical dissociation that people talk about in textbooks, but we didn't really think it was that common until we started to discover it in the hospital, where it was really the most common form of seizures. And that's been looked at across centers and across ICUs and across different parts of the hospital. And so that's definitely the most common. We do see a clinical seizure here or there that prompts people to get hooked up or to undergo EEG monitoring if they don't wake up. But generally, far and away, the most common is subclinical.
And sorry to interrupt, but subclinical, for those who don't know, subclinical are seizures that don't manifest clinically, meaning you can't actually observe a patient and tell what kind of seizure or if the patient's actually having seizures, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And so what are some of the difficulties in managing care for a patient who's actually could possibly be in subclinical, let's say, status, which again is seizures that are just constantly going? What are some of the difficulties in patients who you actually can't see any clinical manifestation of the seizure symptoms themselves whenever you're trying to care for them in the ICU for a longer period of time?
Yeah. So the first challenge is obviously getting them hooked up and finding them, finding these patients, right, that need to be treated. The second challenge is, when you load your first anticonvulsant, and that doesn't work, then you add a second anticonvulsant and that doesn't work.
Is that typical whenever a patient comes in with subclinical?
I'd say it's typical. There's a lot of work on this. There's been recently some publications, not even, I guess, recently, when you're old like I am, then everything's recent. But, within the last 10 years, there's been a focus on sort of cyclical seizures and some of these seizure patterns that you might see in the EEG that would make you suspect that this is going to be hard to treat. A lot of it, it is new onset status in folks that don't have a history of epilepsy. So whenever you have somebody who doesn't have epilepsy at baseline who presents with new seizures, that's always a concern that they could be challenging. But, if you look at the literature broadly, the first agent works about 70% of the time, and it doesn't seem to matter what it is. So whatever drug you load the first time seems to give you 60 to 70% success in stopping seizures. The other 30%, you're going to need a second agent, and that only has about a 15% chance of working. And then every subsequent agent is less. So the guidelines suggest that if you've tried two agents and you're still seeing seizures, you should go to general anesthesia. So that requires usually intubation and then management in the ICU for these seizures. And at that point, you're going to be kind of in for a little bit of a challenge. And I think there's a lot of variation in practice. So some people will suppress to burst suppression, which is a pattern on the EEG where you get a burst of activity followed by a pause in the EEG and then another burst of activity. And so driving sedation down to the point where the brain is just kind of intermittently firing versus seizure suppression, where you just up titrate your drugs until seizures stop. And then you kind of hold people at that level.
Is there a specific patient that you would put in burst suppression mode versus any other kind of therapy?
No, I'm a seizure suppression fan. And the reason that is that you still have background to follow. And what I find is going back to the, helps too, and some of these other, things, when you start to suppress people's seizures, you can see in the background patterns that are reminiscent of their seizures or predictive of their seizures. They'll have periodic patterns, or they'll have these intermittent runs of rhythmic activity that don't meet our arbitrary definition of seizure. But you know that if you took the sedation away, that would be their seizure, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think being able to track that and the resolution of those patterns is a value add, because I can bring them out of sedation faster, sooner, because I know it's safe to do so, versus putting people in burst suppression. You got to just basically take it all away and see what happens intermittently. And I just find that to be a much, much more difficult way of managing that. And I think it ends up to longer periods of sedation,
right.
deeper sedation, which causes more complications. So to answer your previous question more directly, you know, a lot of the complications from this are pulmonary. So you've intubated somebody, they're not coughing, they're not clearing their airway, so they develop pneumonias on the vent. You know, you have the bowels fall asleep, so then people get constipated, and it creates problems with maintaining nutrition and bowel health. And so there are a lot of you know, secondary complications that come from putting somebody into a coma on purpose to treat their ongoing seizures, and those can be really challenging.
Is there more of a risk for a patient who is in medically induced burst suppression when they're coming out of it to actually kick off a seizure event or maybe even status?
I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know that that's really been looked at. You know, you'd probably have to dive into an animal model to really get into that. Although, you know, I have this background in neurophysiology where we studied goldfish and other critters. Burst suppression represents really a hypersynchronous background, you know, because
when you say hypersynchronous, what do you mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the bursts are, you know, rhythmic and they're recurrent. They're somewhat different time intervals of suppression in between, but those bursts represent excitatory activity that breaks through this barrier that you've applied to try to suppress the activity. And so, you know, that bursting is this, when you look at the pattern, the amplitudes are high, and it's holistic. It's over all the channels. So it's telling you that the whole brain is firing sort of at the same time during those bursts. And so that's a hypersynchronous. The whole brain is doing that activity at the same time together. And so that certainly seems like not what you're after, right? It's not a normal brain activity. And, you know, seizures can sometimes represent that same type of thing where a large area of the brain or even the whole brain is synchronously firing this abnormal pattern at once. So I don't view burst suppression as being a win over seizures necessarily, but it doesn't meet our criteria. And so we use it, and the sedation usually settles down some of the areas that might be triggering seizures. So, you know, it works, but there's definitely some controversy and with some new studies maybe suggesting that seizure suppression may be better than burst suppression. Just for the reasons I mentioned, it just seems to shorten up your length of stay on the ventilator and in the ICU over time.
And how long has seizure suppression been a protocol with these patients versus burst suppression?
For me, forever. I've always done seizure suppression. But for others, you know, I think since we started discovering these seizures, there's been a variation in practice in terms of how to manage them. I think, you know, over the years, what I've seen is more aggressive upfront, you know, and the AES guidelines certainly have reflected this as well. Early detection, early intervention, early transition to general anesthesia, knowing that the longer these go on, the harder they are to treat, and that you're more likely to have a prolonged stay if you don't jump on it early. So going to early anesthesia, I think, makes sense. And that's giving us a little bit of this data that maybe seizure suppression is enough to get through these periods in some of these patients. I think for as long as we've been doing this, there's been sort of a two camps of right. how to manage it.
Yeah. So speaking of these patients who are in the ICU and they are experiencing uncontrolled seizure activity, maybe even in status, what is the mortality rate of a patient who with uncontrolled seizures versus a patient who they're able to control the seizures with maybe the first line of therapy?
Yeah, you know, there are several papers looking at, you know, that population. Like when you find people who are seizing in the ICU, their mortality tends to be higher. You know, status alone carries about a 30% mortality And so that's, you know, that's bad in and of itself. But most of the time, the prognosis is really related to the underlying reasons that they're in the ICU in the first place. So the seizures are sometimes secondary to maybe a traumatic brain injury or a stroke. And so those brain injuries take precedent and kind of dictate recovery and outcome and those kinds of things. So mortality is often more tied to the underlying reasons for the person to be hospitalized than to the seizures themselves. But it's really thought that the seizures add additional complexity, you know, an additional injury to brain injury. And that's why this whole idea of brain monitoring is kind of attractive, because I think we don't know the answer to that, right? In other words, we know that people who come in for elective cardiac surgery, for example, they come in, they go to the OR, they come out, and they have this brain fog. And you know, it's kind of referred to as pump head when they used to go on bypass for these valve surgeries and stuff. And it's not known, like, what is that, right? So it spawned an entire field of research in neuroprotection. Like, we know this person's going to undergo a procedure that they're going to be at risk for brain injury during that procedure. Like, they're going to cause circulatory arrest in order to work on the heart. How do we protect them, their brain, before they go into these procedures? And so you have a whole field of anesthesia, you know, people doing research on brain injury, and you think, why is that? Well, it's for this neuroprotection for surgical procedures. And so I think that leads to specifically to this question of, you know, well, who's at risk for having brain injury while they're hospitalized? Everyone, right? And so, again, it ties into all the discussions we've had so far. You know, if you think about brain monitoring, like the bedside monitoring for cardiac, right, where we have the EKG up there and their blood pressure cycling every 4 minutes, you know, in hospitalized patients, if you were to hook up a brain monitor to everyone who's hospitalized to monitor for injury, you know, that would be wildly high scale volume of EEG. So, you know, coming up with not only a method for applying those leads to all those patients, but maintaining those leads and doing something with that data meaningfully starts to pose some interesting challenges for the industry, you know?
So when you say doing something with that data, let me just push on that a little bit more. So can you, how do the EEG findings influence the broader management plan in the ICU? So especially with inputs from other medical teams like cardiologists and intensivists, et cetera, how does that influence the broader management?
ICU EEG and hospital-based EEG is very different than outpatient, right? So outpatient, you're doing these 20-minute studies, and you're looking really for anything that looks epileptiform, right? Not necessarily a seizure, but spikes or sharps or focal slowing or something that makes you think that this patient has something abnormal or their electrical activity is abnormal. In the hospital, everybody's effect pattern is abnormal, right? They're sick. They don't feel good. They're sleepy. They're, you know, encephalopathic.
They're medicated.
You know, they're medicated. Yeah, there's medications involved. We've put them on new drugs. So the background is already often not normal to begin with. But how abnormal and in what way is it abnormal? So one good example is people who get progressively more encephalopathic while they're on the floor. That generates a neurology consult. The neurologist comes and sees that patient. Could be on the oncology floor, could be on the medicine floor. And they assess them, and their labs are, you know, off by a little bit, but nothing dramatic. And their exam is non-focal, meaning they don't have an obvious stroke or something on exam. And so these are the people that you hook up to EEG, and you find sometimes it's just slowing and they're just encephalopathic because of their underlying illness and is making them sick. But sometimes you'll find things, very characteristic patterns, like we have an antibiotic, cefepime, that can get toxic. And so people's renal function can change as a result of their illness and their hospitalization. And then they get toxic or they get overdosed on this antibiotic, and it creates a very characteristic EEG pattern that once you do the EEG, you're like, oh, this is the answer, right? Yeah. There's been a whole bunch of papers on the use of EEG to evaluate encephalopathic patients, and how there are not only just characteristic patterns, but there's also ways to exclude things like non-convulsive seizures from being the underlying driving force for their altered mental status. So I think it's, you know, in medicine, I always say the best tests to run are tests that no matter what the result is, we learn something.
Right.
Right. So to run a test that is only going to be helpful if it's positive is less useful than one that tells me something no matter what the outcome is, right? Mm-hmm. And EEG is like that. You know, you hook people up because no matter what the answer is, it's useful. It guides your decision making. It's not seizures. I don't need to think about that anymore. Right. I got to figure out what this is, right? Yeah. What is my other alternatives for this clinical context? And so I think that's useful. And that's how it plays into decision making.
So can the EEG detect anything other than seizures?
Well, for sure. I mean, I gave the cefepime example. That's one. You know, there are some neurodegenerative diseases, like prion diseases, that create some interesting patterns that are very specific. We have a few hypertensive crisis conditions that produce edema in the back part of the brain, and that produces a very characteristic seizure pattern that's focal and starts there, and there's some slowing and sharps in the posterior leads in the EEG. And then there's periodic discharge patterns, which might be only on one side or on the other. So you get these very rhythmic, repetitive, synchronous discharges that suggest there's a focal or structural lesion over there. So even if you don't see it on exam, there's lots of parts of the brain you can have a problem and not have motor weakness that you can pick up. And if somebody's altered, they can't tell you that their left side's numb or their right side's numb. That's why EEG is kind of an extension of our exam, because we can see these patterns and say, oh, this person really needs imaging, or there's definitely something structural here that's causing or contributing to their current clinical state. I think the clinical context is so important, though, more so than outpatient. Outpatient, you know, you're screening people for epilepsy. It's a pretty ubiquitous, clinical context that you obtain a routine. But in the hospital, everybody's situation is different. And I find it necessary to kind of have some understanding of that clinical context that I'm reading the EEG, because it might change or influence the way that you are interpreting what you're seeing, depending on the clinical context. I always tell the fellows, I can diagnose pneumonia on EEG. And they do that. They laugh. They laugh at me. They're like, come on, Dr. Coles, really? You're going to diagnose pneumonia on EEG? And I tell them, well, it's all about the clinical context. And so, it turns out that our cardiac unit will not use bed percussion. So the beds can bounce people to kind of help keep their lungs clear. And the reason the CCU doesn't do that is because they have wires that run into people's hearts. Mm-hmm. And if you bounce wires around, then it creates problems, arrhythmias and things. So they don't do that unless the patient gets pneumonia. So when you're EEGing somebody and you see bed percussion in the CCU,
they have
pneumonia. So it's not so much that there's a characteristic pneumonia pattern on EEG.
Right.
But in my hospital, in my unit, in the right clinical context, I can diagnose pneumonia. Right. Yeah. And so I think that's a good example of how you can use EEG to, understand what you're looking at, and in the right clinical context might change the way that you interpret some of the waves.
Speaking of clinical context, and going back to my question about the difficulties of subclinical seizures, you had mentioned, you can't get the patient's feedback. My right arm is numb. My left arm is numb. So that makes me think, there's more to the difficulties of subclinical than we probably even just realize.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by definition, as we mentioned before, subclinical means that there isn't a clinical overt sign that this person's having seizures.
Yeah.
And so the only way to know is to hook them up to EEG. It's been looked at across hospital populations. So altered mental status, meaning you're no longer responding normally to questions, whether it's quiet delirium or agitated delirium. I mean, we've seen a number of cases where people are episodically agitated, and that's postictal agitation. Yeah. They're having seizures, and there isn't really a situation in which you can take an altered patient in the hospital and not potentially be worried about seizures as being an underlying contributor. And what the literature bears out is that somewhere between 15% and 40%, with the high end being really the pediatric population, we haven't really seen 40% in adult studies. Adults, it seems to be more around 15% to 20% of folks with altered mental status are having seizures. And whether or not those are contributing directly to their overall clinical state is controversial. But it certainly seems that we should treat things that we can treat to optimize outcomes, and it's fairly easy to treat these. And a lot of these folks don't need to be on drugs long term. So we've seen that even in brain tumor patients, We had a publication a number of years ago where we looked at managing seizures in brain tumor patients, and there was a combination of three drugs we called the trifecta that seemed to work really, really well. But then we looked at outcomes at a year in that population to see where they stuck on those three drugs forever. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the outpatient brain tumor neurology team was very adept at getting people down to monotherapy for their seizures. And some people were off, but most people were on a single agent. So, you know, I think that, you know, even in those difficult to control cases up front, long-term, they don't need all those drugs. And there's opportunities to scale back from what we're doing in the hospital. So I don't feel like we can really over-treat, you know, to the point where people are condemned to be on drugs they don't need for the rest of their lives.
Right. So let's say an EEG comes across your table. You're looking at it. The altered mental status isn't caused by seizure activity. What are some of the things that you think about if that's not the main issue?
At our facility, you know, we have a consult team that kind of runs around and does all that. And I did that for years, both at our community hospital and staffed those consults at the main hospital. And, you know, you try to look at new drugs. I mean, 90% of the time, we just have to raise our hands as physicians and say, I did this to this patient, right? I put them on a new drug that's making them sleepy, whether it's pain meds or, you know, a new anticonvulsant or new something, you know, it's usually our fault. And so the other thing is we've taken things away, right? And so I give a lecture every year to the residents about working up encephalopathy, you know, and altered mental status consults, because we just see it so frequently. It's our most frequent consult request. And so our role is really to kind of think about all the other things, even delving into the more rare things in those circumstances. So like autoimmune conditions that can be triggered by cancers. So having sort of these immune-related seizure disorders or status that can pop up, or even just channelopathies. So antibodies that are specific to receptors that cause alterations in mental status, but may not even cause seizures. So, but they might have characteristic patterns on EEG or other things. So the EEG is still helpful. But once it's negative, then you kind of take that off the plate, and you start to think about these other reasons, whether they're iatrogenic or whether they're metabolic. You know, a lot of times, at least, it's reassuring that you've done all you can, and now it's a tincture of time. The hardest thing to do in medicine is nothing. Right. For certainly in the ICU.
Yeah.
That is one of the biggest challenges, is just to give people time.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's our role, you know, as neurologists, is to say, hey, look, we rolled every stone. We're all done finding, you know, bugs and critters. There's nothing there. They're just going to need time, you know.
Perfect. Okay. So I want to speak on a little bit of controversy here. I know that there's controversy around how to treat focal epilepsy in the ICU. What is your thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, similar to, you know, we were talking about burst suppression versus seizure suppression. You know, the need to take somebody who's having focal seizures, particularly if they're not causing them loss of consciousness. So if you have a focal seizure, at the extreme end of that is EPC or epilepsy partiale continuous, right? They might just have a thumb that twitches, and it might make them crazy and that they can't use their hand very effectively because their thumb is constantly twitching. But you know, would you put somebody under general anesthesia for that? Right. And if they are, having focal seizures in one area, but they're otherwise awake and talking, some people would say that those are going to spread and it's just going to get worse, and you should definitely, you know, treat those. And so I'm willing to throw some anticonvulsants at those to try to make sure that I scale them down as small and as focal as I can. But I generally cut my losses there if they're clinically doing well. But other folks would say, nope, that you should really try to suppress those and put them under general anesthesia, electively intubate, and try to stop those completely, because they'll just continue to cause problems. And, you know, I don't think we know the answer to that. There isn't any long-term outcome studies on that. But you know, we mentioned before all the complications that come with iatrogenic coma. And putting people under general anesthesia for days or weeks, and then not knowing. And what I've found in my practice over 20 plus years is that those seizures come right back. They're very difficult to suppress. That area just has to kind of burn itself out. And really what usually, how we find those patients is, they're patients that were having altered mental status. We hooked them up. They were having secondary generalization from this focal area. You loaded them on a couple of drugs that scales down to now this focal area. You wean off your sedation. They wake up, they're doing fine, but they're still seizing. And so then you have to decide, am I going to put them down again, or am I going to continue to treat this, or add 5 anticonvulsants to try to stop this and put them back into a stupor, you know?
Yeah.
So I think these are all, you know, really, great questions, you know, around focal seizures. A lot of these will have some kind of structural, or at least on MRI, some kind of signal, but not all of them, which is even more confusing. Like, why is this one area so angry? You know, that it's constantly seizing. You'll get a little signal change on MRI, but there's usually not a big structural lesion there. A lot of focal seizures, though, are from prior brain injury. So either prior trauma or more commonly old stroke, yeah, you know, can produce these focal areas of epilepsy down the road.
So when it comes to focal epilepsies or focal seizures, you said it's, you know, sometimes we just don't know what the cause is or what, how to even treat it almost. How far along are we to actually understanding more about focal epilepsies for those ones that we didn't really have a better, have a good understanding in general? How far are we into understanding that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, neurology, unlike cardiology, like I always, it's been the bane of our existence, right? We're always about 20 years behind cardiology. No matter what we do, we're like, oh yeah, cardiology did that about 20 years before us. And the reason is that we have small populations, and, mm-hmm, and what you're describing is a very small population. So, you know, focal epilepsies that are de novo, there's a term called NORS, or new onset refractory status epilepticus, tends to hit young people. You know, when you delve into these refractory status cases, sometimes you'll find autoimmune disorders, and the discovery of anti-NMDA receptor antibodies, causing seizures and sort of progressive decline in cognition in relatively young folks was a big discovery. So the suspicion on our part is that's more common than we give it credit for in this population, with new onset, weird, non-lesional seizures that often start on one area and then maybe start to independently come out of multiple foci. Those were very worrisome. And so we very early go to pheresis, or washing the blood of antibodies, to try to reduce the titers and assume that this is an autoimmune based process. So as part of our seizure intervention, based on these EEG patterns, and the imaging that's negative, we start to make these conclusions much sooner now, mm-hmm, because we've learned that these autoimmune things are out there and we can't test for them all. And so we just kind of presume that that's the case. Freeze these folks, and there's a subpopulation there that respond well to that and stop seizing, and you're able to sort of say, ah, there's something going on here. We're going to need to immunosuppress these folks down the road. And so, you know, I think that's been a growing area, but, you know, how close are we to identifying everyone?
Yeah.
You know, I would argue the stroke folks haven't figured it out, right? Like, there's 30% of stroke that's, you know, a stroke of unclear etiology, right?
Right.
And so I don't feel too bad not knowing the 3 or 4% of seizure patients,
yeah,
that I can't explain why they're seizing.
Yeah.
But at least we have plans for how to manage them, and we can do that very quickly and aggressively.
Talking about these focal epilepsies that are hard to determine the cause for, are we close, or how close are we to understanding the origin of these focal epilepsies or these focal seizures?
I think we don't have great models. I mean, you know, it was neat the way that the NMDA receptor story panned out. And we wrote a paper a few years ago using it as a model for a translation. Like, how do we use, you know, how do we go between the lab to understand and diagnose something that was happening in people? So we saw this phenomenon, took it to the lab and studied it in brain tissue slices. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, people maybe not know, but you took CSF, spinal fluid from patients or serum, and they would put it on slices of rat brain, and then the antibodies in the patient's blood would stick to specific cell types in the tissue, which then you could see on the microscope. And that was how a lot of this stuff was diagnosed. So you just have to send all your labs to Mayo, to Dalmau's lab, who did all these studies early on. And that was kind of how we made these diagnoses of receptor antibody encephalitis and encephalopathies. And so, you know, I think, you know, those kinds of discoveries are just take time. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different antigens or things in the brain tissue that it could stick to. And then there's species differences. So not every antibody that a human might make to your our brains is found in an animal model. So there's limitations to that technology in terms of being able to make those diagnoses. So I think it's a combination of, you know, having the right technology and the right things. And then you're talking about a really small population. So, you know, until they became a national referral lab and right. they could get enough samples to really put together the case and really adequately describe these patients and what they look like, it just remained a mystery. You know,
yeah.
it was one off case here or there.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to see that all come together.